Welcome to Hour 2 of the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest in this hour is Richard Wolff. Richard is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts. I heard him give a talk titled Capitalism Hits the Fan, and boy, has it ever. I was very struck with what he had to say, and I pretty much agreed with him right down the line, so much so that I said, we have to get together in this program and discuss this, because it's the key topic of the day, along with the new administration coming in. So it's vital. It touches everyone's lives. It's doing it more and more. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. And just a word more about Rick. He's well known for many, many years, four decades or so, for his work on Marxian economics, economic methodology, class analysis. He's a prolific writer. And again, in a recent talk on capitalism hitting the fan, he calls the situation today what it is. It's the greatest crisis in our lifetime. There's no question about that. Rick presents a Marxian analysis of it, proposes a socialist solution. We want to talk about it. And Rick, I must say that I never studied Marx in my college or graduate education. What's a guy like me? I'm a graduate of the Wharton School, an MBA from the Wharton School, Rick. What's a guy like me vilifying the system that they weaned me on? Well, it needs to be vilified, because everything you say about it is right. I guess Marx said it too. Antarctic, ungovernable, now it's coming apart at the seams. I mean, how much more of this do we have to take before we realize that this thing doesn't work? We need something that does work. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's a joy to have you on. When you hear the music strike up, it means we have a break, and the first one comes on in a minute or so.
Okay.
So we'll break, and then we'll come back. We'll still get about 50 good minutes of discussion.
Good.
But there's no question that we have what may very well turn out to be a huge calamity that's unfolding in front of our eyes, and the dominant media does their best. To keep the gravity of it from us, but we see data that keeps coming out that gets progressively worse, and I don't expect this to improve for a good long time to come, and it really does show that we have an unworkable system and we need something else.
Yeah, I think the data, as they come through and looked at by folks who study economics, we're as amazed as the average American citizen, even those of us who foresaw that what was happening over the last 20 years was not sustainable, would not have imagined that it hit the wall so hard and so badly when it finally came to that. And yes, it is now opening up an abyss in front of the American people, and indeed many of the rest of the world's countries too, that is frightening. It's frankly frightening. The only thing more frightening than this crisis is the effort of folks to pretend to themselves and to others that it isn't there and that we can just somehow muddle through.
Oh, we are not going to muddle through this very easily. This will be around for a long time. It most likely will get a lot worse before it ever gets better and before things stabilize and start improving. I truly believe, and I'm not an economist, I'm not an expert, but I truly believe that it will be a long slog for many, many years before we really begin to see things expand again.
Right.
And we can go into the policies that are being undertaken right now that I personally think are counterproductive. But I hear a break coming up, so let's do that, Rick, and then we'll come back and jump back into it again.
Okie doke.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Professor Richard Wolff. We're talking about the economic crisis. Rick, you talk about, and I absolutely agree with you, even though I've used the terms you say I shouldn't use. I have used them since I've written an awful lot about this myself. You say that the current crisis did not start with finance, and it won't end with finance. And it really is a systemic crisis, not so much a financial or an economic crisis. And I absolutely positively agree with that. But I'll let you expand on it.
Okay. I think, first, that your listeners deserve an explanation, however brief, of why so many folks keep calling it a financial crisis. I think it's an understandable desire to pretend to themselves and others that this is a contained crisis, that it's limited to whom it will hurt and who will get caught up in it and who will suffer. That's understandable, but it is inaccurate. The causes of this crisis are systemic. They're all over our economy, as I'll explain in a minute. And the consequences, I used to have to say, will be felt. I don't have to say that anymore. The consequences are being felt everywhere in this economy, whether it's the car makers, whether it's the Christmas shoppers. You will see day by day the evidence mounting of the fact that this deserves to be called an economic crisis because it touches every facet of the American economy, and it will, at least for the next several years. So let me try briefly to explain why it should be understood as having been caused by crisis. It starts in the 1970s when a basic change happened in the United States that I think few folks have come to really recognize yet. And the way to explain it is to briefly summarize American history. From 1820 to 1970, a remarkable period of 150 years, real wages in America kept going up. That is, when you adjusted for prices, the money that a working person got allowed him or her to buy more stuff decade after decade. It made America a very special place because no other country has been able to do that for 150 years for its people, steadily increase their standard of living. Americans came to think that was somehow part of being an American, that it was somehow built in, that there was something happening in America that wasn't happening in other countries, which is indeed why so many people from other countries keep coming here, to do better than they can do at home, and basically they have. And it built into the American people also the idea that you can measure your own success as a person by what you have, what you can afford to buy, the house, the car, the clothing, the vacation, and so on. It's American, this rising level of consumption made possible by rising wages. In the 1970s, the rising wage regime of America stopped, and it has never been resumed. That is, if you adjust the wages American men and women get for their work by the prices they have to pay for the goods and services they buy, they are slightly worse off today than they were 30 years ago. That is, their wages, in terms of what they could buy, stopped rising. Now, in an America built on rising wages, allowing rising consumption, the end of rising wages in the 1970s traumatized our population. I mean, it meant to American working people that what they had come to expect, what they had come to use as a measure of their personal worth, was no longer going to go up. And what were they going to do about it? Were they simply going to accept it as simply in the cards, as the end of 150 years, that they would have to now adjust to being people whose standard of living did not go up anymore, whose children would not live better than them? Well, maybe that might have happened in a society where a lot of effort was given to helping people overcome the meaning in their lives of the end of rising wages. But there was no such help in America. There was no such service, not privately, not by the government. Instead, what happened was that in this land of consumption and consumerism, the advertising agencies kept battering the people with the importance of having more, of having the latest telephone, the latest TV, the latest car. All the pressures to consume more were working at top speed, but the wages to pay for it had stopped rising. And so what happened in America, which is part of the crisis we now have, started in the 1970s. Workers whose wages didn't go up anymore took two strategies to try to deal with the situation. The first one was send more people out of the house to do work more hours. In other words, if your wage per hour is not going up anymore, maybe you can solve the problem of getting a higher standard of living by making everybody work more, and particularly America's women, who left the household starting in the 70s in huge numbers to take paid work. The problem was it didn't solve the problem because every family discovered that if mom leaves the house and doesn't do the work in the house that she used to, because she's got an eight-hour-a-day job, they're going to have to spend money, these families. They're going to have to spend money on child care. They're going to have to spend money on work outfits for mom. They're going to have to spend money on a second car, et cetera, et cetera. So solving the problem by doing more work, which did have the effect of exhausting and straining the American family, didn't work as a way to allow more money to buy more consumption. So the American working people did a second thing. And here we now get close to the crisis. Americans began to solve the problem of having no more rising wages while they wanted to keep consuming the way the advertisers told them to. American people solved the problem by going on a borrowing binge. They borrowed more than any working class in any country in the history of this planet. Over the last 30 years, it's spectacular, the American family going into debt. Today, the average debt load of the American family exceeds significantly its annual income. And that was never true before. So we now have a working class in America, come year 2008, that is physically exhausted from all of the labor, whose personal and home and family relationships are strained by the work everyone is doing outside the house, and whose anxiety levels have been ratcheted up to extreme by the level of debt they're carrying, which they basically know they can't sustain over the long period. So we now have a situation in 2008 when the results of this long-term absurd situation are coming to fruition. We have a working class that can't do more work and that can no longer afford to borrow any money because it's too heavily in debt. And those who are at the most vulnerable edge of the situation, who borrowed too much or whose job income has fallen or who lost their job, are facing default. That is, they can't pay back those loans that they knew somewhere they couldn't and shouldn't have taken out, but which everybody was taking out, so they felt safe in doing it. And now the whole house of cards kind of comes down tumbling as the foundation of the situation is no longer there. Let me tell you the second way that this crisis was built up over a long time throughout the economy. Look at the whole story I just told you, not from the standpoint of the worker, but from the standpoint of his or her employer. In the 1970s, real wages stopped. That is, the employer class in America no longer had to raise the wages of its workers. Meanwhile, the productivity of the worker, the amount of goods and service the worker produced each year, kept rising. With computers, with new automation and technology, with pressing workers to work harder, you were able to get more and more out of each worker for the company to sell, but you didn't have to pay the worker anymore. Well, you don't need an advanced degree, neither from an economics department nor from a business school, to understand that if you're getting more from each worker year by year, but you're not paying the worker more, then the difference is called profits. And the last 30 years have been the most bonanza of profits that America has ever seen. It's been a field day, a dream for capitalists. Their ultimate kind of idea of how business should work. Rising output from each worker whom you employ, and you don't have to pay the worker anymore. You keep it all for yourself. And so we had the crisis of labor paralleled by an unbelievable euphoria of profit for the business community. And now the final stroke. The business community was awash in profits, and so deposited them in banks. And what banks do with money deposited in them is lend. And the banks figured out that the American working class, in the 1970s, the richest working class in the world, was the perfect target. They were desperate to accumulate more consumption, to do more, to buy the new goods the advertisers were shrieking at them. But they didn't have the wages to pay for it. Solution: borrow. Every bank struggled with every other bank to flood our mailboxes with credit card applications. In the early 70s, most Americans didn't have credit cards. Today, most Americans have multiple credit cards. The credit card, together with the mortgage loan against your house, were the ways that banks cashed in on the upset of the working class, that its standard of living was no longer rising because the wages weren't going up. It cashed in by lending them money.
Rick, I have to interrupt you again to take another break. It's such a vital story that you're telling, and you tell it so well. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back into it.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
To the News Hour, I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with Rick Wolf. We're talking about the systemic economic crisis, the terrible dilemma that's going on right now that is very, very global in its effects, and it's not going away in a hurry. Rick, can I interject a brief personal story? I'll make it very brief. Something that's impossible today. I spent most of my former working life in small family business, but for a half dozen years or so, I was a marketing research analyst. In 1964, I went to work for the B.F. Goodrich Company. On my very first day on the job, an astonishing thing that it's impossible to happen today. Again, back in those days, even for professionals, income rose faster than inflation. Inflation was just beginning to kick up in those days. We had cost of living increases, something that I think that terminology is out of the lexicon today. But on my very first day on the job, ironically, was on the day of the year that Goodrich gave a cost of living increase. And my boss called me into his office, barely concealing a smile, saying, "Well, Steve, we're so happy with your work that we're giving you a raise." And then he explained it. I just happened to start on the day that everybody in the company, I think from top to bottom, got a cost of living increase. It was a few percent, whatever it was. That doesn't exist today.
Very, very rare. Very, very rare. The norm that it's developing in America now is contracts that, with workers who are lucky enough even to have a contract, where the wage increase is either very small or, for example, in my own case at the University of Massachusetts, we've just been informed that our wage increase this year will be 0%.
Mm.
And if you put together the fact that our money wage is not going up, zero, and the prices are now rising in America at a roughly 5 to 6% clip, then the de facto effect on us is a drop in our standard of living over the next year alone of 5 or 6%.
And they rigged the data, Rick, to make the bad numbers not look as bad as they really are. The real inflation numbers are much higher than the reported numbers.
And I'm just using the official reported
numbers. The CPI or whatever.
And, you know, for a young school teacher trying to make a living, this is very bad news and makes you, you know, feel badly about yourself, about the institution that is hiring you, about the commitment of the society to teaching and schooling. And it's the social effects of an economic downturn like this are always long-lived and very complicated, and they affect our politics, our culture, everything about our society, which is why they are so devastating a part of the economic system we live in.
It really is. It's a system that just seems unfathomable to me, that people would not take a good hard look at their own lives, Rick, and say, why am I doing these things? The more I do what I have been doing, the worse off I am. I just have to make a change. So you talk about people running up unsustainable credit card debt alone, paying off just a little bit of it at a time, not giving a thought that they pay 20% or more interest on the balance. It's a golden goose for the credit card companies if they get people to pay this. But now people can't do it. They're defaulting on their credit card debt. They have mortgages that they refinanced. They can't handle it. The initial teaser rates on adjustable rate mortgages are being reset. Millions of homeowners are at risk. So many, I forget the numbers, thousands are being foreclosed on each month.
Well, the estimate over the next year or two is in the millions. That the number
millions.
Of foreclosures, depending on who you talk to, a statistician, is in the range of 1.5 million to as high as I've seen 4 million.
Oh, I've seen numbers much higher than that. And the measures that so far have come out to address this problem seem woefully inadequate. It really gives all the benefits to the lenders. And some of the things I've seen have let homeowners live in their homes, pay what they can afford, some ratcheted down amount of money, but build no equity in their home. They would be better off walking away from homes that are underwater and simply renting for a lower amount, and probably more and more will end up doing that.
Oh, they're already doing that.
They're already doing it.
They're already doing that in huge numbers. Have been walking away. This has plunged the banks into a further problem because when the people leave, and especially if they go to another state because they can't sustain this anymore, the bank then has the house on its books. The house is losing value literally every day, and the bank is looking at a declining value that it has to report to its shareholders, which depress the price of the bank stock, which depresses all the people that are doing business with that bank. It's on and on and on. That's why it's a systemic crisis. It is now everywhere. What's happening in the world of finance is damaging the rest of the economy, just as what's happening in the rest of the economy reacts back and further deteriorates the financial sector. I do want to stress a couple things. One, there is an unfortunate tendency some folks have to see this as somehow Wall Street badness. The last thing I want to do is defend Wall Street, but it just isn't so. If you understood the explanation I gave in the before the last break, you'll see that what built up to this was a condition across America. Every employer had the benefit of fixed real wages that stopped going up after the 70s. Every employer made more money than otherwise he or she would have been able to. Every employer put that money in the bank. Every local bank used that money to make more and more loans with this free deposit money they got from these
Rick,
corporations.
We need to take another break.
Okay.
We need to take a break. We'll be right back.
All right.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Rick Wolf. Rick, one more break in the next half hour, so we have a lot of time. In case you missed it earlier today, the NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research, made it official. We entered recession. They dated it December 2007. Well, at least they said it.
Yes.
But the whole world knows this, and I guess no comment about the severity, just the fact that we entered the recession last December. I think they judged it based on when they think employment peaked, and it certainly is on a downward spiral right now. But please continue with what you were saying.
Yeah, I just wanted to finish that point that the crisis built up across America. In every town where employers were able to get away with no longer paying higher wages, in every town where they deposited their resulting growing profits in the bank, in every town where the local bank made injudicious loans or hired or paid off local mortgage hustlers to persuade people that they could afford loans, which we now know they couldn't, all of that was done across the United States sure, Wall Street got in on the act, as did everybody else, but it's a problem of how our economy works that brings everyone in to this kind of ill-advised and, in the long run, extremely damaging behavior. And that's why, to deal with this problem and to deal with the fact that we have had booms and busts coming one after the other for 100 years now, it's long past due that we stop looking for a quick fix that doesn't deal with the underlying problem. The kinds of things that the government is doing now, which is to put an ever bigger Band-Aid on the problem, is an attempt to avoid realizing that Band-Aids, even big ones, will not get to the underlying situation. If all we do is make cheap money available in huge quantities, which the Federal Reserve is doing, if all we do is have one quote-unquote stimulus package after another, we're not dealing with the system itself that produces these kinds of events over and over again, necessitating the government to intervene in this massive way. It's about time that we faced up to what are the structural parts of our economy that produce and keep producing these kinds of crises, of which this is only the latest and, in our lifetime, the greatest example.
Oh, there's no question about it. And we're talking about gross excesses, whether it's excess consumption, excess debt. And the analogy that strikes me, Rick, is it's like prescribing another drink for a drunk as a cure to his alcoholic problem.
Right.
And that's exactly what we're doing now. The policies seem so wrong-headed. What they may end up doing, if they pour enough money, I mean the amount is incredible. They're writing that up on Bloomberg. Bloomberg has the number up to $8.5 trillion in recent months, either already doled out or allocated to be doled
right.
out.
Pledged is what they say. Yeah,
pledged, I guess.
That's right.
I mean, these numbers seem very surreal to me. I can't quite fathom numbers that are that big. And I'm sure they're not done. I'm sure there'll be more trillions. And we're just talking about this country, not what's going on around the world, which I guess is less excessive than what's happening here.
No, proportionately, it's not quite as big as here, but it's getting up there.
It's getting up there, my goodness.
The Chinese, the Japanese, the Europeans, and those are the big three other economic power groups in the world, are pumping money into their economies, trying to do stimulus plans rather like our own. No, this is a global crisis. And it is a global crisis which the people who run the world societies are trying to deal with precisely without questioning the basic system. It's as if they didn't want – let me use a metaphor for you. If you are starting to feel badly about some portion of your body, your arm or your leg, and you use a variety of things for arms or legs, and they don't kind of work, you sort of begin to understand it would be wise to go have a health professional give you a kind of an exam, an overall exam, just to make sure that there isn't something systemic that might be wrong. Because if there is, you'd want to deal with that quickly rather than waste your time putting Band-Aids on something that might be a cancer. We're in that situation now. The government is slapping one larger Band-Aid on top of each smaller Band-Aid in an attempt to deal with the problem without asking whether there could be something systemic wrong here. And I think that's a terrible disservice to the American people, because if the system itself is what's producing this problem, as I frankly believe it is, then Band-Aids are not only not going to solve the problem, they're losing valuable time, which nowadays means millions of people's jobs, as they go around with a kind of head-in-the-sand refusal to look at the systemic possibility of what's wrong here.
They just want to milk this thing for all they can get. And I have some very evil thoughts, Rick, that the people profiting the most that have made out so well, even after the dot-com business burst in the early part of 2000, And then Alan Greenspan engineered low interest rates and all the things that you talked about, encouraging people to refinance and run up more debt on their credit cards. So we got rid of the dot-com bubble, and we inherited the housing bubble, and we have a debt bubble.
Right.
And I guess we had an oil bubble when oil came close to $150 a barrel.
Right, that's a perfect example. When the dot-com bubble that was absurd in the late 90s, when it finally burst in February, April, March and April of the year 2000, what did the government do? Try to understand how this kind of bubble works in our system, how this, not at all. What they quickly did, Alan Greenspan leading the way, was flood the economy with money, drop the interest rates faster and further than ever before in America to keep the economy going without making any systemic change. And what did people do with cheap tons of money at low interest rates? Well, they went out and they had, as you put it, a housing boom, which became a housing bubble, which has now gone bust. The problem today is there is no new bubble that can be built up. And even if there were, this is not the right way. By failing to deal with a system problem in 2000, we have a much greater system problem 8 years later today. And if we don't deal with that now, the same story will be repeated 3, 4, or 5 years from now yet again, although this one is so bad, my guess is that there may well begin to be, in the next year or two, what there was in the 1930s in America, an upswelling of demands from people who've lost their jobs, lost their home, had their credit cut off, or in other ways are really under the gun now, demanding something that really changes the situation, or otherwise they really can't go on. And we're going to have the kind of crisis and the kind of trouble in our society that comes when you put one part of your population under extreme deepening pressure while they continue to look across the fence at the minority of people who've made out like bandits with their enormous salaries and their cushions of stock portfolios and so on. And I fear for this country. I fear for the kind of political turmoil that usually follows this extreme difference in the economic experience of the population.
Rick, I had economist Michael Hudson on the program some weeks back, and he gave a startling statistic, worse than I imagine. He said in his judgment, the top 1% of the population owns 70% of the wealth today.
He's not that far. It's a bit more than most people say, but even the normal statisticians in America, those who work for the Department of Labor or the Department of Commerce or the Internal Revenue Service, when you talk with them and when you read even their publications, they basically agree that the top 1% owns over half of the total wealth of the United States. The conventional number is 1% of shareholders own 75% of the stocks. So, you know, this is a society that has already been extremely unequal. But as many of us have learned over the years, an unequally distributed wealth and income typically does not get challenged so long as the bottom two-thirds of the population are experiencing a rising standard of living. They tend to be willing to let other people make out as bandits as long as they can at least steadily improve their situation. What we have now is that the bottom two-thirds, their situation is not only not going up, it is deteriorating, and that makes them much less willing to tolerate the inequality that before didn't seem to bother them so much, which is why I think serious and reasonable people have much to fear in the years ahead in this country.
Well, we could go on and on at length on this, and I want to get into your proposed solution, Rick. There's no question, and I believe this. Michael Hudson also said he came back from a trip to Germany, I believe, and got together with a group of economists. The general consensus they came up with was we are heading into another depression. And I honestly believe that that is the likely possibility. And very, very possibly, I certainly don't know. I can't see the future. very possibly because the excesses are greater than back then, it could turn out worse than the 1930s.
And yeah, people who question that, I agree with you, people who question that should remember a little piece of recent history. You don't have to go back to the 1930s, which is, after all, 80 years ago, to come up with an example. We have a perfectly good example much, much closer to us historically, and that is Japan. In 1989 and 90, Japan was the second most powerful industrial country in the world, number two after the United States. It began to enter into a recession with a collapse of its credit market and a collapse of its real estate markets, very like our own. Over the ensuing years, from 1990 to the present, that's an 18-year period, the Japanese government tried all the standard steps, exactly like those being taken by Washington now. Monetary policy, flooding the economy with money, lowering interest rates. The Japanese were famous. They lowered the interest rates to minus numbers, that is, less than 0%. And they had all kinds of stimulus packages of tax cuts and government spending on infrastructure and on all kinds of other things. None of it worked. The Japanese are still experiencing an 18-year depression and see no end to it, especially now that the rest of the world is not going to help them because of its own problems. Consequently, the idea that a rich, powerful, modern industrial economy with sophisticated economists and a bevy full of policies can be sure not to have this experience, there's no warrant for such a belief. We can see what happened in Japan, and the notion that it can't happen here is pure wishful thinking.
Oh, it absolutely can happen here. I've mentioned that the Japan story in some of my writing, and for people invested in the stock market, I mentioned that on the last day, the last trading day of December 1989, the Nikkei, the main Japanese average, their equivalent of the Dow, closed just a little bit under 39,000. Well, just a few weeks ago, it was 7,200.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, look at, you know, in March and April of the year 2000, the Nasdaq index was 5,000, and today it's 1,500 or 1,600. I mean,
exactly.
these are drops on a scale that is depression. That doesn't deserve the word recession. It deserves a more serious term. And that's the situation we're actually in. But again, there is this effort to pretend that Mr. Obama or Mr. Bush have some kind of arsenal of policies that we all could and should have confidence in. The historical record, given Japan and given the severity of this crisis, is really very different. Our bet should be that there's no one who understands or knows how to deal with this crisis because we haven't had one like it for 75 years and nobody's that old. And the people should understand that in the view of what the Japanese tried to do, and it didn't work, the odds are it isn't going to work here either. I hope I'm wrong, but a reasonable person has no business with faith, and that's really what it is, that these folks in Washington are going to be able to do it. Mr. Bush, his economic advisors did not see it coming, did not take steps to prevent it, and couldn't cope with it when it blew up on them. And many of those people are very close to and very similar to the people that Mr. Obama is gathering around him. So I'm at a loss to understand the faith that people have other than their perfectly understandable wish that the problem gets solved.
Rick, I have a brand new article that I'll get out later this week on the so-called Obama Economic Dream Team. I see not a lot different under Obama than what's going on under George Bush. But I don't want to let the program end without getting into your solution.
Okay.
Maybe you can pick up on that, and in a few minutes there'll be another break, then a short final segment. But get into your solution that makes so much sense.
Okay. My solution goes back to what I said a little bit earlier in terms of facing up to the fact that this is a systemic problem, that it's a system we have to change. Let me focus then your attention on who makes the basic decisions in this economy and therefore who bears the responsibility for having gotten us into this situation. Well, the answer to that question is corporate boards of directors, that group of 15 to 25 people that make the basic decisions of the corporate enterprises that do most of the business in the United States. They employ most of the people corporations do, they account for most of the sales, and they certainly account for most of the profits. Here we have corporations often employing tens and twenties, thousands of people, but the basic decisions on what wages to pay, on what profits to aim for, on what to do with the profits you get, these decisions are made by tiny groups of people. The board of directors of the bank decide who to lend to. The board of directors of the corporation decide when to take advantage of circumstances to stop paying rising wages and so on. To make this complex story short and brief, over the period since the 1970s, as this crisis now exploding built up, it was the decisions of boards of directors across America's corporate landscape who plunged us into this situation. If they had kept raising wages, workers would not have had to borrow, and we wouldn't have the defaults we have today. If they had invested their money in improving the technical capacity of our workers, they wouldn't have had to outsource jobs to other car parts of the world, etc., etc. We have the problems we do in good part because of the way we organize production.
Rick, let me interrupt a final break and then again get right back into this again.
Will do.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lindman on with Rick Wolf. Rick, a quick comment and then you finish up where you left off. I hope as the cracks get wider in what's going on now in the weeks and months ahead, that I can get you back on the program again so we can address what's happening. And if you give another talk, like capitalism hitting the fan or whatever, I hope you'll send it to me because this is such vital stuff and it's material that needs to be talked about on air. People need to hear about this. They need to know about it. But please finish up your solution.
Okay, I'll be glad to do that. You might be interested to know that a company saw that video that you saw, and I made a film, a documentary film that will be released in 2 months based on that.
Oh,
and I will
marvelous.
Make sure to get you a copy. In
oh,
any case,
marvelous. Absolutely
any case,
marvelous.
Here's the solution that I would propose. To change the tendency of our economy to have these booms and busts, such as the terrible one we're now living through, we have to rearrange the organization of production. We ought to stop letting the key decisions be made by a tiny group of people called boards of directors whose first and chief responsibility is to shareholders. It ought to be changed so that the workers in every enterprise are their own bosses, will come to work Monday to Thursday to do the work and on Friday sit around and function as a board of directors to make the decisions. If that had been the case in the 70s, wages of workers would not have stopped rising. They would have not have been substituted by lending to workers instead. No board of directors composed by the workers in an enterprise would ever do that. And they wouldn't have outsourced jobs, and they wouldn't pollute the environment they have to live in. We would have a number of our problems much more able to be solved if working people were in charge of their own job situations, plus they would work harder. You know, as a nation, we believe in democracy and politics. It's long overdue that we have democracy and economics, too. That the people who depend on their jobs 5 days a week, 9 to 5, for their families and themselves, be able to have real power over the decisions of what is done with the profits that, after all, are only made possible by their labor. And if we did that kind of change, if we at least discussed it as a nation, we would go a long way towards dealing with the underlying systemic problems of our economy rather than slapping increasingly expensive and ineffective Band-Aids on a problem that goes much deeper than that.
And only gets worse because what they're doing is so counterproductive.
That's right.
And if they manage to paper it over for the time being, all they will do is grow a much bigger problem out in the future, and at some point the whole bloody thing falls apart, and heaven help everybody if it does.
Yes.
The way to cure a sick patient is take your medicine, take it up front, take the time needed to cure the disease, and hopefully have a sound, sane policy that will replace it.
At least have the courage to go to people who are trying to solve the problem, who have analyses that go to the root and the basis of the economy
to come up with an analysis. It's not that we're right and other people are wrong. It's that for too long in America, the kind of systemic analysis I've just summarized and the policies that flow from it have been disallowed from the public debate, so that Americans, including professional economists that are advising politicians, simply don't know how to think systemically. It's, again, as if you had a disease, but you didn't allow the doctors who have thought about it, including those with unorthodox proposals, to get in there and talk about what would be the best solution for a seriously ailing patient.
Oh, indeed. And I wish we had another hour to continue on this same subject and get into it in all the details that 50 minutes is never enough time to get into it all, Rick. It's been a marvelous, marvelous hour with you. I think we're getting near the end of it right now. But this will go on for a long time. And,
yes, and I'd be more than happy to talk with you again at any time.
Oh, Rick, I absolutely want to have you come on back and get back into this again. And you take a complicated subject and you make it so easily understandable. I know my listeners appreciated this hour.
Okay.
My great thanks for this
thanks
wonderful
to you
hour.
As well.
Thank you, Rick. And I look forward to having you come back next week. We'll have two more guests, two more important discussions, and we'll continue this every week on the Global Research News Hour.